This Israel report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, Shavua Tov. How are you?
Boker Tov, Shavua Tov, Chodesh Tov. Of course, we had Rosh Chodesh over the weekend as well. I did promise last week that I was going to start this morning with some quotes from a presentation that was made by former hostage Avi Natan Or, who had quite an extreme experience, even as far as hostages go. His experience seems to have been one of the most extreme. And I'm going to read a few bits from a presentation that Avi Natan gave and that's been written down, because I think that listeners might be interested to hear. Obviously, it's quite long, but I'm not going to read it all, just a few things. And he said the following: I tried to escape. I dug for several weeks. I wanted to work to change my fate. One night, I managed to go outside and even see the stars for the first time. I wrote kidnapped on a sandbag, and I was already planning my next move, but the terrorists found out and beat me for days. They tied me to a chair for a week. And then he went on to say that in order to survive, he created a few rules for himself. The first rule, patience. Every day I told myself, just one more day. Rule number two, find a common denominator. I talked to my captors about faith, about the Torah, about the Quran, about Yosef and Yusuf, about Abraham and Ibrahim. Different names, but universal stories. Rule number three, anger destroys you. You can't survive when you're angry. I allow myself to feel it sometimes, but I let go. Rule number four, keep my brain working. My engineering background saved me. I counted steps. I collected data. I built a small lamp from broken cables. I planned my escape routes in my head and told myself, you won't let others decide your fate. Just some snippets from what Avi Natan Or said about how he managed to escape 2 years in a tunnel without going out and being kept alone. One of the other comments that he made was that one of the hardest things was going for 2 years without hearing anybody say his name, without hearing anybody speak his own language. These were the things that he found most difficult to cope with, and he laid these rules down in order to get him through. I think it's a fascinating story.
It really is, but very, very difficult to imagine. Let's talk about the big event yesterday, that the IDF carried out a hit in the heart of Beirut that killed Hezbollah number two. What's known?
Yeah, so this is the Hezbollah chief of staff, someone called Taba Tabai, whose name many of us have never heard before. And he has only been the chief of staff for a relatively short period of time, because, of course, the IDF have already killed two Hezbollah chiefs of staff during the course of the last 2 years. So even though he's someone who hasn't been in office for all that long, it seems as though he was sufficiently influential and a really old-time Hezbollah operative to justify the IDF taking the risk, going into the heart of Beirut, and once again carrying out what can only be considered to be a phenomenal clinical strike, with intelligence that knew exactly which room, in which apartment, in which building in central Beirut Taba Tabai was housed in at that moment. A number of different missiles, it seems, were sent into that apartment because there seemed to be a number of different holes in the wall. But again, this is a residential building in the central part of Beirut. It's very congested. It's very built up. It's very urban. And yet, that was the only building that was hit. There were other people who were with him. We understand that there were four other Hezbollah terrorists who were in the vicinity of Tabatabai when he was hit, and they also died. We understand that a number of people, other people, were also killed and injured in the process. But, I mean, when you think about trying to strike in such a built-up area, in such an urbanized jungle, with apartment buildings everywhere and civilians roaming around the place, I think that the quality of that strike is just phenomenal. Of course, the IDF doesn't get any accolades or credit for that. Instead, lots of criticism about how it is that the IDF can strike the central heart of Beirut once a ceasefire is in place. And this is a violation of the ceasefire, and of course all the regular accusations that will be leveled at the IDF and against Israel. But it's too late, because the man was taken out and he was killed, and he was considered to be a major threat to Israel. And this also sends a message to the Hezbollah Secretary General, Naim Qassem, to say, you also should be sleeping with a helmet on, because I have little doubt that the intelligence have got his whereabouts down pat, and if necessary, could attack him as well. It may require slightly more sophisticated weaponry and missiles. It might require a slightly different size attack. But the message that has been, there are a few messages that are being sent, not only to people who are militating against Israel, cooperating with Iran, trying to rebuild Hezbollah in Lebanon, trying to recuperate the damage that was done by Israel during the war. But it's also a message that says the intelligence is working, and even if there is a ceasefire, if the Lebanese government can't deal with these kinds of threats, then Israel will not hesitate to take care of it. And now, having created a situation where it is so much easier for Israel to go in and carry out these strikes before the war began, this kind of a strike would never have been contemplated, because the repercussions would have been so dramatic and the threat to the IDF would have been much, much greater in carrying out this sort of attack. Now, the repercussions are entirely different. The level of threat that the Air Force and those on the ground have to endure in order to carry out these attacks is much, much less due to the work that's gone on the ground up until now. So it seems imminently logical that the IDF will not wait to carry out attacks like this, but rather use the opportunity as soon as it arises. And I think that this is a phenomenal attack. It is incredibly executed, has been incredibly executed. And I think the message that it sends is loud and clear and really important, that you can't, that Israel will not allow Hezbollah to stand back up again, and that every opportunity that presents will be used in order to weaken them.
It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out this week. If indeed this the whatever reaction happens this week, or if it's going to take a while, but we will have to see what happens.
That's true. I mean, there's a great deal of speculation that another war with Hezbollah may well be inevitable, and that is also leading to speculation that another direct conflict with Iran in the relatively near future is also inevitable. Now, I don't see that happening within the next week or two, or even within the next month, but it's very, very difficult to know exactly when such a thing might happen, because now, having cleared the ground already and created the opportunity to clear out more or as much as needed, it seems as if though the IDF will not wish to wait. If there is a need to go into Iran again, if there is a need to carry out a more direct war with Hezbollah again, I don't see any reason why the IDF would wish to hesitate and wait for them to strengthen even more than they have managed to do up until now.
Yeah, it's quite scary. And now, you know, the part of it that bothers me is it feels like Israel has lost some of the ground against Hezbollah over the last year and a half. But let's talk about other things. The IDF intercepted 17 Hamas terrorists who escaped from the tunnel in Rafah. How did that happen?
So we've been speaking over the last few weeks about these 200 Hamas terrorists who found themselves holed up in a tunnel in Rafah. The IDF was aware of this. They knew about the fact that they were there. No effort was made to try to go into those tunnels in order to take care of those terrorists. We understand that some of those tunnels are even within the yellow zone, which is currently controlled by the IDF. But the IDF decided instead to play a slightly longer game in allowing the terrorists just to bide their time in the tunnel. And lo and behold, finally, some of them decided that they need to come out of the tunnels. And this, again, is an incredible job of observation. The observation soldiers of the IDF who sit for hours and hours and days in front of screens watching what is going on various observation cameras that have been strategically placed around Israel's borders and within Israel's enemy territory in order to try to track what's going on and to keep a good watch on events on the ground. So these observation soldiers were the ones who spotted the terrorists coming out of a tunnel. And I'm guessing that desperation is in evidence in that tunnel, because otherwise those terrorists would have stayed down in the tunnels. I'm guessing that they had no other reason to come out other than either they're running out of food, or they're running out of air, or they're running out of patience, or whatever it might be. But a group of approximately 17 of them was spotted coming out of a tunnel, initially only three or four, and then afterwards a few more. Ultimately, the IDF engaged them. Five, I think, were killed pretty much right away. Some of them managed to escape for a period of time, but after they escaped, the IDF obviously hunted them down, continued the observation process that goes on. These cameras really can get in everywhere, and of course there are also observation drones that are used to see what's going on the ground, which is, of course, the drone has been very much the new element of this war, which has been so extensively used not only for observation but indeed for carrying out attacks. And again, those attacking drones were used in this operation as well. Ultimately, out of the 17 terrorists who have so far escaped from that tunnel in Rafah, 11 of them have been killed and six of them were arrested. Now, the six who were arrested are critical pieces of information, because that will allow the IDF to interrogate them in order to try to find out a little bit more information about what's going on down in those tunnels, what the mood is, how much time there might be left in terms of food and supplies, patients and air and anything else that is needed in the tunnel to keep the others there. But apparently there is still quite a large group, more than 150, who are still down in the tunnel. So this is just a slow process of ultimately forcing them out of the tunnel at their own pace. When things start to get really desperate, they're going to come out. And then obviously that's the opportunity that the IDF will use in order to pick them up. So this is a great victory, I think, in terms of being able to pick up and kill those terrorists, and a great victory for our observation soldiers, because let's not forget that those observation soldiers were some of the ones who were on the front line and who bore the brunt of the October the 7th attack. And many of those observation posts that were at that time stationed around the Gaza border area were attacked. Many of the girls were killed, were sexually abused. Some of them were kidnapped into Gaza. So this is a great victory to allow our observation soldiers to get a little bit back and to get the job done, to observe those soldiers, to observe those terrorists coming out of the tunnels, and ultimately to allow the drones in to take care of them or to arrest them, as we managed to do.
Incredible. Finally, the IDF, and this is actually a huge, huge story, but let's talk about it at least briefly. The IDF chief of general staff has taken steps to fire and punish IDF officers whose failures led to October the 7th. It has taken a long time, Anthony, hasn't it?
It has taken a long time, obviously more than 2 years now since October the 7th took place. And so the question is, why has it taken so long? And I think that First of all, the fact that the IDF have internally decided that this is necessary, I think, is a very important step. There are many, many problematic parts to this whole story. For example, the fact that some of those who are being relieved of their duties in inverted commas or who are being punished have already left the IDF over the course of the last 2 years. So they're not even really there to bear the brunt of their punishment or really to be fired as such because they've already left. So there's some questions being asked about that. But I think the main two reasons why this has taken so long is, first of all, because we had a water fight. And I think that the IDF, even though they failed Israel substantially on October the 7th, there can be little doubt about the level of the failure that took place. And, you know, there are many questions about how far up the line that failure actually went, but there is little doubt that within the ranks of the IDF there were significant failures. But the IDF, to their credit, managed to regain the ground, managed to somehow assert or reassert their authority, and ultimately carried out a war on Israel's behalf over the last 2 years, which really gives a great deal of pride to all of us. And we've seen how individuals have behaved and how the country and the army have stood up against this threat and really taken care of it. 960 soldiers killed in the process. Unfortunately, a very, very high price for us to pay. But the IDF ultimately had to fight a war, and they decided to stand up, regain the ground, and to fight the war. And while that was going on, you couldn't really hold courts and hearings in order to hold IDF officers responsible. There was a war to be fought, and the war had to be fought without any other distractions. The other point, of course, is that IDF Chief of General Staff Eyal Zamir was not the Chief of General Staff on October the 7th. And I think that that is a critical point, that it really required somebody else to step in rather than the Chief of General Staff who was on duty at the time. I don't think that he could rightfully have overseen this process. So it really needed a new face to come in and to be able to look back and independently make judgment. And it's interesting that IDF Chief of General Staff Eyal Zamir said IDF has been committed to a thorough, professional, and in-depth inquiry of everything that occurred on October the 7th. And he says, I've taken a series of steps to advance the issue, including the establishment of an independent review to examine the inquiries and their findings. But he also said that it has been very difficult for him to have to punish people who he very much respected, friends who he very much respected. And so this, for him, has been enormously difficult.
That is where we have to leave it. It is 8:01. Anthony Reich, thank you as always. Let me have your thoughts on 061-895-1019.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands.